This is Pamela Banos, and I'm speaking with David Keene, the President and Senior Archaeologist for Archaeological Research Incorporated. Thanks for agreeing to speak with me today, David, and for agreeing to let me use this interview as part of my web project that I'm going to be publishing online.
Oh, I'm honored.
Thank you. So can you tell me a little bit about your background in archaeology and the kind of typical work that you do, and then sort of segue into the work that has led you to become part of my project here?
Okay. I have a PhD in anthropology from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I've been doing archaeology since I was in high school. I actually went as a high school student, attended a program at the Field Museum one summer, and did excavations in the Chicago area. And once I started, I just couldn't stop.
What excavations were they doing in the Chicago area?
They were doing an excavation out in the Palis area, an area called the Palis Site, which is at about 113th Street and LaGrange Road.
Huh.
It's on the far southwest, in the places where there's lots of moraines and stuff. And it's one of the largest prehistoric Indian villages in the Chicago area that still exists. And that was back in 1969. So I've been doing archaeology ever since.
That's great.
Most of my career in doing archaeology, I have had a couple stints teaching, but most of my career has been running this company doing what we call historic preservation archaeology. There's a whole body of federal and state law that requires any federally funded project or project funded by the state or any project that requires a federal or state permit to take into account archaeological or historic resources. And so that's what we do. We usually work with state or federal agencies that are engaged in what's called an undertaking to disturb the land for some reason, most of our work is with building highways. And we have to check the areas first to make sure they're not going to disturb any archaeological or historic significant resources.
So they hire you to make sure that they're free and clear?
Exactly. That's what they hire us for. And if they're not, to get to the point where they are free and clear, to remove things that might be in the way.
So we were just discussing before I started recording our conversation your experience in working at the Dunning area. The site is called Dunning? Or
it's called Dunning because the people that owned the property before the county bought it were, their last name was Dunning. It was the Dunning Farms. The city of Chicago, you have to remember back in the early and middle 19th century, though they didn't even have trains like we have today. And so, the areas surrounding what was then the populated part of the city were all farms. And the Dunnings grew fruit. They had all kinds of apple trees and other types of fruit trees, plums, and things that would supply the city of Chicago with fresh fruit seasonally. And so they owned most of the land there. Most people find that kind of interesting that was all farms and it was considered far away from the city. Now It's within the city limits and, you know, within a 10-15 minute drive from downtown.
So that's Jefferson Park today.
Okay. Yes.
And so Dunning became known historically as the place where the county poor farm went.
The county poor farm was established on that Dunning property, and it became sort of a facility where not only the poor and indigent were housed, but also became a place where people who were mentally ill were housed and had, you know, no other place to go. Homeless people, the mentally ill, and people who were sick and couldn't afford medical care.
And so they also had their own cemetery.
They had their own cemetery there, and it was because it was county property. It became the county cemetery. So anyone who could not afford to be buried in a private cemetery in the city was buried at Dunning.
And this is actually after the city cemetery ceased its burials.
Yes,
at that
yes.
time. So after 1866, and maybe right around the time of the Chicago Fire, maybe slightly before then. And my research has actually shown me that is where they were disinterring bodies from the city cemetery's Potter's Field to the Dunning Cemetery, which became Chicago's Potter's Field, essentially.
Exactly.
The county. And so you were hired in 1989 as part of a project. So tell me that.
What happened was over time, in the around the turn of the century, around 1900, the state of Illinois came in inspecting the county facility and found that there were people sleeping in the hallways, and many of the patients were not being cared for up to what the state standards were supposed to be at the time. And so the county very gladly sold the entire facility to the state for a dollar. And the state began a very active building campaign. They built hospitals, all kinds of facilities, because the population in the city of Chicago was just booming. It was growing very rapidly, which would mean that there were, you know, lots of people who were poor, lots of people who were mentally ill that needed, you know, care. And so they would actually begin to build things. And in some cases, since the cemetery wasn't, it appears, I can't say this for sure, but it appears that the cemetery didn't have good records in those days, that they would bury people as they came in. And you have to remember that, you know, prior to, you know, the 20th century, you know, with things like insurance and Social Security that came in, you know, one day you could be a pretty prosperous individual, and within 2 or 3 weeks, you know, you could become an indigent very easily, you know, through disease or through, you know, the loss of a breadwinner in the family and things. And so people's economic status fluctuated tremendously. So people were buried at Dunning who just didn't have money at the time to be buried at the regular cemetery. But when the state took over, they just began, you know, they came in with their planners and they began building regardless of where people were buried.
So they built a big compound in there.
They built a very big compound with lots of buildings. It was quite a campus at one time. By the 1970s, with changes in the way we care for the mentally ill, many of the buildings became abandoned, and the state began surplusing them, tearing them down. And eventually by 1989 sold the property to developers. And of course by this time no one even remembered that there were bodies buried there. So a developer came with his plans, began laying out his grid, and they were actually digging the sewer lines along what would be the platted streets, and human remains started coming up.
And so they contacted me,
yes.
And so the law that's in place right now that has to do with any bones, I guess, specifically is referred to, that are found that are more than 100 years old need to be sent downstate.
Yes.
Was being enacted while you were working on this project?
While we were working on Dunning, they were in the process of putting the law together and writing the enabling legislation and the statutes that go with that law. So we were sort of, Dunning was sort of the first test case. In fact, they began changing some of the statutes in order to fit, you know, things like Dunning, because they just hadn't come across something like this before.
So what was the volume or the sort of mass of what you found there? And there's a huge memorial now.
Yes, there is. That was a complicated project because when we went in, everyone that we talked to, and all the documents that we came across suggested that there was only one 5-acre plot where people were buried. And we all thought, the state archaeologist and I thought, we just didn't have a good sense of what the boundaries of that 5-acre plot was, and that the developer was somehow encroaching, you know, on that 5 acres. But what we found over time was that there were actually 3 cemeteries there.
Uh-huh.
And there was one very near Narragansett Avenue, one probably about 2 blocks west of Narragansett Avenue, which is where the developer at first encountered human remains, and then another cemetery that is now underneath Forest Preserve Drive, on the very end, and underneath the parking lot for the current Reed Mental Health Facility. The parking lot on both sides of the street and underneath the street are filled with graves.
So they just left it all intact?
They just left it all intact.
Because they knew that, I mean,
that's right.
What would they have done with them?
Well, you know, there's no reason to begin disturbing.
Right.
It's sort of the policy, don't disturb human remains if you don't have to. And in many ways, having an asphalt parking lot on top of them. It was placed there unintentionally, but we now know that there are there are thousands of people buried there. There's no reason to, you know, begin tearing that up.
Okay, and that makes
yeah.
a kind of sense.
Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit now about, I suppose, how the law that was enacted in 1989 then sort of set the precedent for what happened next in terms of the kind of work that you do. And so leading up, let's just jump to 1998,
sure.
the excavation of the parking facility that became the lot for the Chicago History Museum, then the Chicago Historical Society, and the protocol that was in place that said that if you know that there was a cemetery there, that there are certain things you need to do to verify that there is nothing left there. And then
exactly.
the point being that there used to be a cemetery there, that according to the written record, it has been excavated.
Yes.
That nobody's left. But since you know that the history of the grounds, there are certain things you need to do.
Exactly.
And so 2 to 3 years prior to the actual job, you did what was called a scoop test. So can you explain to me that?
What happened was they did call us, the Chicago Historical Society called us in 1998, as well as the state archaeologist called and said that he had directed them to me, that he wasn't going to allow them to build a parking lot in Lincoln Park unless they had an archaeologist take a look first. He said all historic records suggest that the cemetery had been, all the human remains had been removed or
mm-hmm.
vacated from
mm-hmm.
that cemetery mm-hmm. in the 1870s and early 1880s, as late as the early 1880s. But as we archaeologists know that oftentimes people are left behind, that even though there's good intention, once you start moving dirt around, it's very easy to miss somebody. So he asked, his request was that we go in there and do an investigation to see if there were any intact human remains.
So this is prior to 98?
This is, this is probably about 1990, no, it was 1996. Probably 1997 or 97 or summer of 98.
Because
sometimes when we do investigations, they stretch over a period of time.
Okay, but it's before the actual job started.
Before the actual job started, yes.
Okay.
And so the area was already a surface parking lot with lots of mm-hmm. tree lawns mm-hmm. in between. And we developed a strategy that was okayed by the state archaeologist to dig in the tree lawns, you know, to see if there was any indication of human remains, and to dig around the parking lot. And so we did. We have a small little backhoe that can be operated by hand, and we began digging, you know, test units down 6 to 8 feet below the surface. And in all cases, we did come across human remains, but the remains that we came across appeared to be not in graves, but to have been scattered. Even when people were removing graves in the 1800s, you have to remember people were buried in wooden coffins, and so those wooden coffins would disappear. And as they would be excavating for someone else, they might disturb the grave next to that grave, and bones would get left behind. And so we found a number of scattered human remains during those testings.
So bits of bones in different places.
Bits of bones. After we got that evidence, the state archaeologist decided that the best way to proceed would be to allow construction to start, the earth moving to start, and to monitor that construction so that if any human remains were encountered during that period of time, we could go in and remove those remains.
Your firm.
My firm, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
So that's what you did.
And that's exactly what we did. When actual construction started 2 years later, we had a couple people on staff monitor everyday excavations, and we did encounter more scattered human remains in the excavation, but there were a couple of instances where there were intact graves that were encountered.
So what would an intact grave look like?
An intact grave would generally, at the Chicago, all the intact graves that we encountered no longer had coffins, except in one case, which we'll talk about a little later, but were wooden, the people clearly were buried in wooden coffins that had deteriorated. Sometimes we'd find some hardware, but the sandy nature of the soil there, even many of the coffin, much of the coffin hardware was disintegrated over time.
There's no wood at all.
There was no wood. In one case, there were strips of wood at the bottom, but they were so fragile that we couldn't even, we couldn't even save them. They just broke apart completely. So they were more like stains than they were anything else.
I actually came across a document from the 1860s or 50s, maybe, where the city sextons at the time, or the gravediggers, were excavating bodies while it was still an active cemetery from people who had not paid for their lots. And they were putting them into certain lots, which sound like, from what I've learned about mapping out from the surveys, it sounds like in the area where the parking garage was, which might explain why there were bones in places that don't look like they were parts of rows or in some sort of organized way. And they put them into like five different lots, and I have the lot numbers. And each of these lots were 9 by 24 feet. And so that's a huge area.
That is a huge area. You can put a lot of bodies in 9 by 24.
And whatever the state the bodies were at that point even, they weren't in any kind of organized family plot, which makes now sense to me, the stories that now you're telling about scattered remains, and that what Don Cobb was telling me about commingled remains, where there would be evidence of, from your notes, a body and then another body somehow. And it didn't make sense to me until I found that document.
Well, if we can jump forward a little bit, when we did encounter a cast iron casket, and to our surprise, once we removed that cast iron casket, there were human remains underneath casket, skeletal remains underneath that casket. So it which led us to wonder, we were unable to find any grave stains, any shaft where that cast iron, which led us to speculate that either that this casket may have been moved around even during the removal phase, and they may have just lost it, because, in sandy soil, when you're digging for things, that sand moves around quite a bit, and can move things around very easily. So,
it's interesting to hear this from your perspective, because it seems inconceivable for people who don't know your practice how things could possibly be moving around in what we see as a solid mass.
Yes.
And so just from erosion or just from... and the activity of the people digging and moving and removing bodies. And
as many archaeologists tell you, especially those that work on European cemeteries that are 200 or 300 years old, it's not uncommon to find a grave in which you'll find a few bones from the people in the grave next to it, because soil moves. Mm-hmm. We think of the ground as being solid and sturdy, but it does move around quite a bit, and things do migrate, because of water and all kinds of other factors.
Well, and so today's contemporary cemeteries, they put these giant cement vaults down. And
those don't
and
move very easily.
gets rid of some of these issues, which is also how I think some people can't understand how there's just bones and how people got lost. And, and again, Don Cobb spoke to me about how just with vandalism or with a marker that gets removed, that just means you don't know who was there.
Exactly.
And so it's not even, in addition to the kinds of things that can happen by moving things around, just by having a marker missing, there's at least, there's something that's not accounted for that's beneath the ground.
Absolutely. And in sandy soils, I can't tell you enough how difficult it is, even when you're doing a controlled excavation archaeologically, how easy it is to miss somebody, especially a child, the skeleton is not necessarily complete. It's very easy to miss somebody as you're doing some controlled work and thinking that you've got everybody.
So tell me the story about the iron coffin.
The iron coffin was an autumn day. It was a nice autumn day, and I was standing talking to a couple of people from the Chicago Historical Society, and the construction manager and a colleague of mine, the archaeologist for the Army Corps of Engineers. He had come out because he would come out periodically to see what was going on. He was very interested in the excavations in Lincoln Park or any excavations in the city of Chicago. We were standing around and talking, and one of the foremen came over to talk to and ask the construction manager if he could talk with him privately for a few minutes. And I thought, well, that was kind of peculiar, because usually the foreman would come up and interrupt us, and because they have work to do, they've got to get things done. And it And I turned to my colleague, the Army Corps archaeologist, and I said, oh, I bet you they found something. Mm-hmm. You know, and sure enough, the construction manager came back and said, you know, you need to go over and take a look. They think they hit a coffin and broke off the corner of it. And I just assumed from everything we had seen in the excavation that they were talking about the corner of a wooden coffin. I thought this would be kind of interesting mm-hmm. because we hadn't found any wooden coffins yet. And we walked over to the area, and the backhoe operator pointed to an area, and he said, it's over there, and there was nothing exposed. He said, no, I put a bucket full of sand on top of it, you know, to cover it back up. And so you have to remember that this is a construction site, so there's deep holes in various places for, you know, the construction of walls and stuff. And so this right adjacent to this grave was a pretty large hole. So we were able to stand in the hole and begin sort of at face level to remove some of the soil as if we were like on a sand dune. Mm-hmm. And that would be the best thing the best analogy. We're sort of on a sand dune, you know, scraping the soil, you know, to begin uncovering the grave. And we were very delicate to make sure we didn't disturb anything. And all of a sudden, I began to uncover what appeared to be a foot, toes, you know, of somebody. And then there was a tremendous odor. And at the same time, the Army Corps archaeologist, you know, had stumbled upon the piece of the coffin that was broken by the backhoe. It was a piece of cast iron. And so we removed ourselves from the situation, a few feet from the situation, and recognizing that this grave had a person who was still pretty well preserved, the protocol requires that I notify the medical examiner, the county medical examiner. But in order to do that, I had to call the police first. So I called the police. Police officer came and he said, well, gee, this isn't the usual kind of bodies that we find. He said, what am I supposed to do? And I said, well, you now need to call the medical examiner. And could we?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry, because some of you, I never.
So someone just came to the door, and we had to stop. And so now I was in the throes of your story, and now I forgot actually where you
are. No, I know exactly where
okay.
I am. That we discovered that there were that there was human remains that still that were not skeletal, that they were still intact human remains, encased in a cast iron casket, and the protocol requires that we contact the medical examiner. But I can't contact the medical examiner. A person can't. The medical examiner has a protocol of his own that he can only be contacted by the police. So we called a police officer who thought this was kind of humorous because he said this is not the usual case of a body when we find one. He said, even in Lincoln Park, he said, this is not the way we usually find bodies. And he asked me, well, what am I supposed to do? Why did you call me? And I said, well, you now need to call the medical examiner. And so he called the medical examiner on his cell phone and handed the cell phone to me. And the medical examiner said, what are you doing digging in a cemetery? And I said, well, you know, they're going to be engaged in constructing a new parking lot here, and it's, you know, used to be a cemetery. And he said, well, probably the best thing to do would be to check with the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency to see if they would want the human remains. He said, but as far as he was concerned, he thanked me for notifying him, but he didn't want to be involved anymore. And I called the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, and you know they reminded me that the law states that they have jurisdiction over skeletal remains and not necessarily over intact human remains that were over 100 years old, no longer in a registered cemetery. And I said, who do you think has jurisdiction mm-hmm. over intact human remains that are over 100 years old, not in a registered cemetery? And they suggested that I call the Department of Health. I dealt extensively with the Chicago Department of Health at Dunning, so I knew the people there, and I called them, and they instructed me that I needed to, that this was an easy situation to take care of. I just needed to get another container, as they called it. I like these euphemistic mm-hmm. phrases, mm-hmm. a container, which basically is a coffin, mm-hmm. to, you know, place this individual into another container and rebury it. seemed pretty simple to me at the time.
That you're just following instructions.
Just following instructions, right. Exactly. And people seemed to be, you know, pointing me to the right direction. So I called my neighborhood undertaker, who I know very well. And I said to him, you know, Louis, I've got this problem. I've, you know, came across, you know, encoffinated, you know, cadaver in Lincoln Park on one of my excavations, and I need to get a large coffin to place it in. And he said, well, I can get you the coffin very easily. You know, how big do you need it? And he actually came out and we probed. We didn't uncover the entire casket at this time because we didn't want to uncover it or expose it until we actually were in the would be able to remove it. And so we probed with some probes to get an idea of what size was needed. He then informed me that he could very easily get me a brand new casket, but he asked me if I had a permit to exhume the body, and I said no, I did not. And he said, well, you're going to have to get one. Well, in the meantime, I'm calling around, you know, trying to figure out what to do with this body, and I called a cemetery and asked them if I could bury a body in there, and well, no sooner did I hang up the phone. I thought that was a pretty innocent conversation, not knowing very much better. No sooner did I hang up the phone than my phone was ringing that someone from the medical examiner was calling and saying, are you calling cemeteries trying to bury a body? That, you know, we just got a call and they want to know who you are and what you're doing talking about burying a body. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset anybody. They said, you know, you can't just be burying bodies and you know, you need to talk to the undertaker. And so I called my undertaker friend, and he said, you know, it's very simple, Dave. You just get a permit, that you know, an exhumation reinterment permit. And I said, well, where do I get one of these? He said, well, you can get it either from one of two sources. You can get it from the medical examiner's office, or you can get it from the Department of Health. And I said, all right, well, that seems pretty easy. So I got back on the phone and talked to the medical examiner, and he said, he doesn't want to have anything to do with this. He's not giving me any permit because he doesn't see that this is his jurisdiction at all. I then called the health department, and they said they didn't see that this was their jurisdiction at all and that they were reluctant to give me a permit since they'd never done anything like this before, had given anybody a permit for anything like this before. So I went back and forth with the various agencies, including the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, who my experience with the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency always was and has been always ever since that they're always very helpful and can, you know, get an archaeologist in any kind of problem through a situation except this one time. No one seemed to have a solution for how to do this since they had no ability to, you know, issue a permit.
So they're the skeletal remains.
They're the skeletal remains. If these were skeletal remains, we would remove them from the ground and they would go to the Illinois State Museum because they have, you know, a designated repository. Mm-hmm. But nobody wanted a cadaver that was 150 years old. For especially in a casket that was now compromised by construction equipment. We left the body, the encoffinated body, in the ground for about 3 or 4 weeks. Until, you know, in that time, I'm trying to figure out what to do. And I'm every path I try to go down, I run into a dead end. Yeah. I run into a dead end. So finally, I did order the casket from my undertaker friend, and he gave me the casket. I pulled up to his funeral home with a big white panel van that I had rented. We put the casket inside, took the casket over to the construction site, and this was early one morning, the day before Halloween, as a matter of fact, in the year 2000, and 98. Began removing this. My crew and I, we began excavating this because we now had a container to put it in. And so we removed this with the help of construction workers because this was a very heavy object. We removed it from the ground, placed it inside a brand new coffin. We placed the coffin inside the white panel van, and I called the medical examiner, and I told him what I did, and that I had no place to put this this coffin except leave it on the streets. And he said, and I said, you know, that could be dangerous, given the fact that it's the day before Halloween. People looking through the windows will notice a big coffin inside. And he said, well, you know, I don't want to have to be picking this up off the street on Halloween night. So you can bring that newly containered individual to my office, because there's no place else it could be stored. It would be breaking the law to bring it into my archaeological lab or to even rent a garage to park the van in. It would be against the law. And so he allowed me to bring the individual to the medical examiner's office, and he told me it was mine, that I had to figure out what to do with that individual. So I did get it out of the ground without a permit, but now I was faced with the problem how to get it back into the ground, you know, without a permit. The medical examiner, of course, has a very large staff, and his chief aide was there to greet me when we brought this casket with the human remains in, and he looked at it and he said, oh, you know, Dave, we'll take care of this for you. We bury indigents on a regular basis here, and we will just bury this individual with our other indigents. And so I thought, this is wonderful. Story's over. Done. You know, it's all finished.
Did your deal.
And so this is the end of October, beginning of November when this is happening. And so I had a very nice winter, you know, processing things from that, you know, writing up reports and getting things done. And in the middle of March, my phone rings, and it's the medical examiner. And he said, Keene, when are you going to get this body out of here? And I said, oh, I thought you guys buried that individual with the indigents that you bury on a regular basis. He said, that individual, you know, was placed in a very expensive coffin at the time. This individual is not an indigent. I'm not burying it with the indigents. You have to rebury this person.
Five months later.
And I said, well, I'd be happy to rebury that individual, but I need a permit, and you are the only one who can sign that permit to re-exhume this individual. I mean, rebury this individual. And he said, all right, fine. I will sign that permit, but don't do this again. And so he signed the permit, and we were able to acquire a cemetery plot at the Irving Park Cemetery, and we buried that individual that day at the Irving Park Cemetery for the second time.
At least, as far as I know,
this is the second burial of that individual. Yes.
So, do you feel close to this person? I mean,
I actually did. In fact, I would tell my wife and other friends that I wish I was a good writer, that I could write a story, because I could imagine being that person in the casket and looking up, and, you know, at least two or three times a week, I would come with three or four other people and stand over that grave and talk about what a problem that person, you know, is posing for the construction of the cemetery. And I thought, wouldn't it be an interesting story to tell it from that person's perspective?
Point of view.
You know, here I thought I was at rest, and probably for a long time there was nothing but children playing on top of the grave, and then, you know, parking lot, and now people were talking about me as a problem, you know.
The thing that strikes me about this, the whole story, well, your end of the story, is that this person got this kind of attention that became your deal.
Oh, yes.
And
it did,
for however long it took, that went into months, you took responsibility for reinterring this person. I guess because nobody else would, on one
hand. Well, that too, and I really do think that the anthropological community doesn't talk about it this way, and neither do other communities that are concerned about human remains, even the Native Americans, but I call it residual dignity, that human remains have some sort of residual dignity, that we need to, we don't not necessarily protect them or, you know, go out of our way necessarily, but we should treat human remains with some respect, because they were at one time, you know, a living, you know, person who loved people and, you know, did great things and, you know, suffered through life and enjoyed life. And so I do think these remains have some residual dignity. We should treat them as such.
Yeah, I like that you did that, which seems above and beyond your duty as an archaeologist, and maybe because it wasn't archaeological either in the state.
No, it wasn't.
And then the other thing it makes me think about is that this person obviously wasn't indigent either then or now, but because they were buried in an iron coffin, which is pretty unusual.
Yes.
And which you needed some money to be able to be interred that way.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
the fact that they then took this final journey and ended up the way that they did in modern times, I just find really interesting.
It is. It is. I think this kind of thing happens a lot, and we're going to see more of it as cemeteries, as you know, in the city of Chicago, cemeteries now sit, you know, in very prime real estate land. And there, we've had a number of cases in the past decade where developers have bought the periphery of cemeteries. And we've actually had to investigate areas where, you know, a developer would buy a piece of a cemetery to build, you know, condominiums on. And we'd have to just double check. We'd have to, you know, assure the state that, yes, their records were in order and that there were no bodies buried. But, you know, cemeteries today, once we're at the fringe or the margins of cities, where today they're engulfed by cities, mm-hmm. and they're on pretty expensive land, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're not, as they get filled up, they don't generate any revenue so for the owners. So the best thing to do is, as many owners have found, is to begin finding ways to get rid of the bodies and sell that land.
Which sounds really harsh.
It does sound harsh.
When you say it that way. Yeah. And actually also to refer to them as bodies, yeah. it feels, mm-hmm. it's a misnomer, because yeah. they're not people.
They're not people, they're remains
and their bones and their fragments and their, you know, their mm-hmm. relics. But that's why the iron coffin person who, because you told me it was a 5 foot long coffin, mm-hmm. I think of that person as a woman somehow, mm-hmm. because although everybody was shorter then, I just I think of her journey, mm-hmm. through that final story, which has this kind of tragic comic quality to mm-hmm. it. I actually really like that story, and I suppose it's because she ended up where she did, mm-hmm. you know, properly interred,
yes.
you know, in a cemetery.
Hopefully for a long time.
And yeah. at least she's in a real cemetery again, yeah. and mm-hmm. she's accounted for, and she's been respected in this. Mm-hmm. She didn't end up fragment of bones.
No, she did not. No,
you know,
she
ended up being hermetically sealed mm-hmm. in what looked like a Fisk metallic burial
casket. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, well, thank you so much for speaking with me and for sharing the story.
Oh, no, thank you for asking. This is nice to be able to tell the story.
And it's a 10-year-old story.
It is a 10-year-old story. Yes. Yeah.
So thanks again.